Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week on Thinking Deeply, we're going to try a bit of format diversification, and we have got, I suppose, a type of lecture, certainly a talk, from regular Neil Almond. We're going to explore reading comprehension and Neil's thoughts through roughly 60 minutes, in which he tries to share the most helpful guidance he can for teachers when thinking about reading in the primary classroom. Now, please do let me know in the comments via email what you thought of this format, whether or not it was something you think, you know, it'd be good to have more of these in the future. I think, you know, I quite often like to listen to lectures online, but don't always have time to watch them. And so, you know, I hope you enjoy it. Let me know wherever you listen. Without further ado, let's spend some time thinking deeply about primary education.
So, thank you very much, everyone. As I say, this talk is all about comprehension, and I thought the most clickbaity title that I could possibly come up with was Comprehend This, Reading is Not a Skills-Based Subject, because I think, and this is what the first half of the talk will kind of look at, is the reasons why I think as a profession we're kind of fed messages both implicitly and explicitly regarding reading being a skills-based subject. But as I say, it is a bit clickbaity. There is an element of skill, I think, in being able to comprehend, but the way in which we teach it shouldn't necessarily look like a skill. So this is Scarborough's Reading Rope. And what I need to make really clear from the outset is that this talk will assume that everything with regards to word recognition, so that phonological awareness, that ability to decode fluently enough with prosody and accuracy, that side of things is taken care of, and that side of things is everything okay. So what do we do, and how can we teach that language comprehension aspect of it, which I've kind of conveniently hidden away from this model just for now? What can we do to encourage comprehension occurring, assuming that word recognition and everything listed there is as we would expect it? But say, before we get that, I just want to go through to why we think reading is a skill. Comprehension is certainly a skill. To kind of start off, let's kind of define what we mean by skill. Here's the one that I'm using just from an online dictionary. So it's an ability to do an activity or job well, especially because you have practiced it. And it's this kind of practice that I want to kind of emphasize right now, because I'm sure many teacher has experienced this. When you practice comprehension as you may be currently teaching, or you've kind of experienced or seen, what you don't necessarily then get is transfer. It would be really silly to think of a skill as something that doesn't have transfer. Sport, for example, if you were practicing a particular football skill on a particular pitch, and that skill then didn't transfer when you were playing at an away pitch, it's not that useful to have. We're fortunate enough that obviously skills like that do transfer. If I can perform, insert whatever football skill here, at this particular time, at this particular moment, on this particular pitch, then when I go to a home pitch, then obviously I'll be able to perform that skill again. In a nutshell, my whole spiel on this, my main message, is to basically say when it comes to comprehension, it tends not to have that transfer, certainly in the way that we currently teach it. But we think it can, because we are usually, sold messages, something like this. So here's a comprehension support book that you can buy for children. And you can say there's the little blurb that goes with it. So this workbook will help your child to progress with essential comprehension skills. That carries on then to, again, the SATS skills builder. Those of us that have kind of drawn to various other websites to help get our reading lesson material, this idea then of obviously, you know, these reading skills packs that can help us out. various other ones as well. So we want to prove, so we're being fed messages as a profession from external areas that are here to help us about improving reading skills. Likewise, our friends at Ofsted, these are all from the new framework, from a variety of different schools. So this school overall was good. And here it's really nice that the teachers use high quality text to teach a range of comprehension skills. However, some comprehension skills are not taught as precisely as they should be, whatever that may mean. Here's another good one. In this case, this idea that they're doing their reading skills quite well because it widens their vocabulary. In this require improvement school, pupils move up the school, they develop a range of comprehension skills. And if, again, linking to the conversation that just happened, if heads are reading this, they're going to be thinking about, right, what are we doing about comprehension skills so that when Ofsted do come and visit, we can be prepared for it. In this case, something that happens delays the use of comprehension skills. And it's an inadequate improvement. One of the inadequate schools here, something was effective that they so that they don't develop their comprehension skills effectively to deepen their learning across a range of subjects. In this case, though, they do develop those that fluency and comprehension skill. Some teachers here, and even in this good school, require further support to teach reading comprehension skills. And I would hazard a guess that if you were to ask, and in this outstanding school, this new approach to guide reading has further introduced pupils to develop vocabulary and comprehension skills. And I imagine if we got all the Ofsted inspectors who wrote these reports in a room and asked them individually, what are these comprehension skills you would get, every answer would be different. Or they would be referring to the content domains that are taken from elements of the national curriculum. So the content domains, they're the areas of focus at the end of Key Stage 2 SAT. So all of the questions that you are given kind of can fall into any of these kind of content domain references. You'll be familiar with them because various reading comprehension resources, they tend to have their questions that follow these particular content domains. Because as Chris said, if you were listening to the first chat with Cassie and Tom, it looks like the end performance, and there's that lovely that inherent safety net, if you will, that if we're doing something that looks like the test, then the kids will probably get better when they come to actually doing the test than if they hadn't done the test. And also it kind of tends to happen because I said this is all publicly available. You get to look at the percentage of total marks that on average could be put to any single one Key Stage 2 assessment. And what you tend to see is that the percentage of the content domain is reflected in the question types that you get in the text. What I mean by that is the most predominant types of questions you'll be asked are the retrieve and record information, as well as the make inferences from a text. And then you can see there, yeah, we'll do a little bit of prediction, but not too much. We'll throw a little bit of summarizing. We'll maybe throw one identify and explain meaning. We'll maybe do one prediction question. And then, because we know that prediction isn't really going to come up in the Key Stage 2 SAT, so we don't need to focus on that quote unquote skill as much as we need to do. And because of this, there are kind of entire industries built upon then our kind of intervention systems of how we get pupils through that Key Stage 2 threshold. So we'll obviously then, and I've certainly had to do it, some practice SATs, perhaps in the first term of year six. And then we feed it into the QLA of which questions they got on. There's normally, I think there's about 50, marks out of 50. So there's normally around 40 questions there, 30 kids. That's a lot of ones, zeros, or twos, or sometimes threes that you then need to put in. And then the systems will magically tell me, who got greater depth, who got expected. But then they'll also like break that down then by reading skill. So here you'll kind of see here that Let's see, pupil B okay, so he's all right, but as you see, pupil D, pupil C, in retrieving key information, you know, it's not so great, especially here. Ooh, and an inference, 31.82% of that question was right. You know, that's not good enough. So, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to pull this child out of their lessons in the afternoon, and we're going to give them retrieval and inference question practice, in the hope then that that will improve their inference skills and their retrieval skills. And as I say, my core message is to say that that isn't going to be a good idea. And then you tend to get like a really nice bar graph here at the end that can kind of break it down as to, you know, the percentage of the class that are doing really well in something. So here you can see, oh yeah, that inference needs a bit of work and retrieval needs a bit of work. So you say you'll take those children out, and then you will give them a inference intervention or a retrieval of key information. And one of the things that I used to do, certainly, I found this website very early in my career as a teacher, and I thought it was amazing because you can go and look at. There are so many worksheets that are tied specifically for those particular skills. You can kind of see inference here. You can see that there's theme, text structure, fact and opinion, purpose, characterization. So all of these kind of things, prediction, main idea, which would be our kind of like retrieval, all of these things. There'd be reams and reams of worksheets. In fact, there's one up here for you. I very remember teaching kind of this kind of passage in the hope that what was happening is that all the work I was doing here would somehow then transfer, and all that practice would transfer to when pupils finally came to do their end of key stage two SATs. And what you tend to see, I think Chris mentioned it earlier, is that then this kind of teaching certainly happens lower and lower down the school. You know, I know schools that from year three they'll use a various you know, reading resource or comprehension resources from around year three. That's just kind of focusing on these particular skills. It might be something as obscure as we're going to learn this, you know, focus specifically on this one reading skill for this week, or it's going to be inference Tuesdays and prediction Mondays and then summarizing Fridays, because that doesn't that seem so nice that everything kind of fits neatly and packaged into just one you know, 1 week. But again, the key message here and the kind of core message is that I don't think this works, and it's not just that I think this works, I don't think the research backs up that this is a particularly good idea either. So I kind of got interested in comprehension kind of like four years ago, did lots of reading and kind of came across this when it came to like these kind of idea of like comprehension questions, so like these prediction questions, these you know, inference questions, you know, what are they all about. And so I found this from Timothy Shanahan, who is an American professor in Chicago over in America, and this is what he has to say about reading skills. So if you can't see it on the stream, it's reading comprehension skills was used occasionally throughout the 20th century, but really took off in a big way in the 1950s. Professional development texts and Basel readers were replete with the term, and its use began for about 30 years before slackening off a bit. But basically, the term comprehension skill refers to the ability required to answer particular kinds of comprehension questions. Skills would include things like identifying the main idea, recognizing supporting details, drawing conclusions, inferencing, comparing, contrasting, evaluating critically, knowing vocabulary meaning, usually you know, by reading around the word, and sequencing events. And I kind of think anyone who's done a SATs-based kind of practice paper or an assessment like a GLS or a PUMA, you'll see those kind of questions and these kind of skills reflected in those papers. And then here's kind of the kicker. There are no studies showing that they can be taught in a way that leads to higher comprehension. And even in those few instances where there is evidence, the effects are really small, probably due to a greater attention to reading the text than to practicing the called skill. So, you know, that's pretty comprehensive right there, I think. And I say if Timothy Shanahan says it, it's worth listening. But actually, it gets worse because he then adds the final kicker. There have been a number of studies and the logical analysis showing that these skills lack any kind of psychological reality. And when I kind of read that, that was a massive kind of thunderbolt moment for me, is that the kind of thing that I'd been teaching, assessing against, putting intervention for, these things, they don't have any kind of psychological reality, is not the kind of thing that you want to read, because all of that effort, all of that time is not actually improving comprehension. But not only is it not kind of improving comprehension, but this distortion field that I kind of put around this idea doesn't actually exist at all. So hopefully that's kind of put you set the groundwork. That's where I'm coming from. Prediction, inference, summarizing, all of those kind of content domains that the SATs kind of assesses against, I think don't necessarily, they like kind of, they lack like psychological reality. And the way that we kind of teach comprehension should be almost pretty much not worry too much about those in terms of thinking of them as skill. So now we've done that, I'd love to talk to you now about what I say comprehension actually is. And so I enjoy Snow's definition. So reading comprehension is the process of simultaneously extracting and constructing meaning through interaction and involvement with written language. I really like this definition because it really kind of highlights that construction element, as well as that interaction. And that kind of interaction kind of implies like two people, so that there's the writer who's obviously written something, but the reader themselves need to come, they need to kind of bring something to the table in order for them to actually get to comprehend what it is that they're meaning by extracting it. So extract it, they construct it through that interaction and that involvement with written language. And that's a really kind of useful definition for me, because when I think about how comprehension happens, which is something that I've kind of looked at a lot too quite recently in terms of what's actually going on in our brains, as it were. They say there are many models. My preferred one, just from reading around this, is the kind of construction integration model. It's kind of put forward by a chap called Walter Kinch. It's been around for a kind of a long time, but this most recent research around it is from this 2018 paper that is on the screen for you right now, and it's called the construction integration model, or kind of the situational model. And so what I'm kind of going to do now very quickly is kind of just go through, try to show you what this kind of looks like at the word level and then kind of at the sentence level. So hopefully most people here, they're familiar with the simple model of memory from Daniel Willingham. This particular one is from Oliver Caviglioli. So here's what kind of happens, we think, as we kind of comprehend text. So first of all, here's the kind of the text. So the first step in the construction integration model is to construct more or less a literal representation of the text. And this involves transforming these patterns of dark and light and squiggly, not so much squiggly, but these lines from our eyeballs into letters and words. So what kind of happens is that this then goes into our environment. We take that into our working memory. And then what happens is kind of every experience that we have with that written word, not meaning, every experience that we have with that written word is kind of activated, as it was, in our long-term memory. Now, I've used the word bark here. So in my head, all of these ideas with the word bark have been activated now in your long-term memory. The idea could be a trunk, it could be a tree. Bark is a synonym for shout. It's a type of noise. Obviously, we associate that with dog, and you can kind of see then the connections between all of those things. So the basic kind of building block of Kinch's theory are something that he calls propositions. And a proposition is a way of rewriting an English sentence that makes a clear, single, literal meaning. Now, these propositions are useful because English sentences, they can be really ambiguous, or they may be arbitrary, complicated, and so contain too many propositions. In this case, the simple proposition is just the word bark. So you've got to think of these propositions as a fundamental building block of meaning. But as I say, as you'll find out, we form these greater complex meanings by connecting these propositions together in a really kind of a complex network. So right now, we have a proposition in your head, which is bark. Plenty of experience with this word is now activated in your long-term memory. But you obviously need a bit more to work out meaning from it. Which meaning am I actually trying to get? And the only way to do that is if I bring in something that we can then use to update this construction part of the model. So if I was to show you the word dog bark, just like that, we've introduced a new bit of text. And so another literal proposition, we have dog and bark. So here there are kind of two propositions, and these are, say, propositions are now linked together. And so we're kind of creating and building this network of propositions, and we call this the text-based. And so what we do is that we link these propositions to our prior knowledge. We're in the fortunate position where we've experienced plenty of doom scrolling on YouTube shorts, cute dog videos, etc. So we know that dogs bark, and we link these propositions with our prior knowledge, and these interactions will kind of boost some meaning, but also suppress the incorrect meaning. So because I'm seeing dog bark, this idea of bark being noise and dog gets a boost, and the propositions that could mean, shout, tree and trunk, they get suppressed. So that's kind of how, very briefly, we kind of make this happen. And so that's the integration part of it. So let's see how this now works for a sentence. So here's a nice sentence. It says, time flies when you're having fun. That's the environment. We take that in, we put that into our working memory, and we kind of start then kind of analyzing it to build up this model. So the first thing that we're going to see then, obviously, we're going to create some propositions. And the first kind of thing we might see then is time flies. Now, time flies, this is an interesting one because just from these two words, I can have several propositions here from the text. I could have a specific type of fly called a time fly. I may understand it as a linguistic metaphor demonstrating the perceived speed of time, or some sort of representation of time, literally flying. Now, I know that you've probably read ahead and read the whole of the sentence already, so that's fine. But what's important here to understand is that, this happens at the word by word level. And if you have a child who is, quite novice in their understanding of, metaphor and literary devices like that, then when they see time flies, they may actually think that there is something called a time fly. But what's important here is that, say, you read that part of it, both of these meanings are activated. So there are three potential propositions here in our long-term memory, but we need more information to know about it before we can then convert that into a meaningful text base. So I'm going to read the rest of it. When you're having fun, okay, so I can activate that. I know what it means when you're having fun, so that's fine. Again, I can now put these two together, and we can kind of link these to form a text base, and this network of propositions forms the literal interpretation of the text base. And so now all these kind of little nodes at the text base activate our kind of prior knowledge. So we kind of have two parallel networks here. We have this momentarily activated one that consists of the text's literal meaning, and this kind of vast dormant network of prior knowledge in which retrieval strength of those ideas can play quite a large part. Because if I can't retrieve these ideas from my long-term memory well enough, then obviously that is actually going to disrupt the comprehension that I'm going to be experiencing. So once I've read this, I kind of overlay this with our prior understanding that kind of give words meaning. Because I'm a relative expert, I know that there's no such thing as a time fly. I know that there is, I don't actually see clocks as a representation of time flying around. And because I'm familiar with this sort of metaphor, I can make sense of what's going on here. That's not a problem for me. But of course, for our younger students, that is going to be a problem. So I've activated that meaning. I can suppress the contradictory one. So I'm getting rid of the time fly. I'm getting rid of this representation of time flying. So I can now make this obvious inference that, aren't necessarily literal in the text. So I can now kind of understand what meaning the author wanted me to get from this particular one. And so when this happens, the term for this is like stabilization. And so this is what we call the integration phase of the construction integration theory. And this happens because one of the possible meanings will not match other information in the text, and also because prior knowledge constrains which meaning is activated in that network. So if the text makes this meaning explicit, a good reader will rely on the text base over the prior word knowledge. However, if text does not provide many inferential steps, we have to fill in the meaning using our prior knowledge of the world. And that's kind of where inferencing then kind of comes in. I've had to introduce this to you in kind of small steps, but obviously the model likely kind of happens in parallel, not the way that I've had to demonstrate it to you now. And obviously, you'll be working with text that's longer than just one sentence. And I say every time we read a word, a phrase, a sentence, a paragraph, we are updating that model all the time, overlaying any possible proposition with our prior knowledge, and then trying to make sense of it. So I hope that's given you a bit of a tasty introduction. So what's actually going on in our or one possible thing that might be going on in our brain as we are reading. So what's the how can primary school teachers kind of make most use of this? I think there's a couple of ways. The most important way, and again, you might be confined to what you can do, senior leaders in the classroom. But if you kind of have to do, and I term, as you can see on your screen, I term these kind of comprehension tasks like the read all and answer. Read all the text on the left, and then can you answer all of those questions? So I'm hoping you can kind of see the problem here is that if my mental model and my construction integration model falls down really, really quickly, and I don't make sense of something in the first sentence or the first paragraph, then actually, when I get to the second part or these interesting facts, that model is broken because I've not constructed it in the way that the author has intended. Now, if I have to answer all of these questions right here, it's going to take me quite a while as a teacher to know at what point did this model fail? Did it fail in this paragraph? Did it fail in this paragraph? And actually being able to think about when you're reading text, when you're reading to children, thinking about, well, how can I, what the questions you should be asking aren't necessarily just inference, although they might be, but actually, what can I do to make sure that this construction integration model that the author wants these people to have is accurate? And so one kind of quick win would be to kind of just break up your questions into kind of chunks like this with the text. So then you kind of get a rough idea then of where the model has broken down. So if I then ask children to read all of this first, so the Earth's crust, and then they can answer those two questions, and then a fault, they answer incorrectly, then I know as a teacher their construction integration model has likely fallen down around that point. And so this is going to make it, I think, far more easier for teachers to actually pinpoint the point of which comprehension has actually failed for those pupils while still maintaining and going through, if your policy on comprehension and reading is to actually, provide things from these various resource sites, then of course, it kind of still does that, but in a way that's going to hopefully be a little bit more meaningful for you. And now that you have this idea of thinking about, well, can now I've got to pinpoint the part in which that situational model has failed, that will hopefully then be able to help you help those pupils. Now, well, if you have been attending research eds for some time, as I've done, and if you kind of read Daniel Willingham's Why Don't Students Like School, a big part of that is background knowledge. So if you want to make inferences, if you want to be a really good reader, then what you need to have is, expert background knowledge in that particular content that you're reading about. That's absolutely true. And in fact, there's some quite nice evidence coming around now that suggests that, it does make a difference. So here's one piece from 2021. The bit in highlighted says review findings highlight that higher levels of background knowledge have a range of effects that are influenced by the nature of the text, the quality of the situation models, that's that construction integration model required, and the presence of reader misconceptions about the text. Our findings also indicate that background knowledge impacts differentially on stronger and weaker readers. So readers with lower background knowledge appear to benefit more from text with a high cohesion, and we'll talk about what that looks like in a moment, while weaker readers were able to compensate somewhat for their relatively weak reading skills in the context of a high degree of background knowledge. And here's another one as well. So a relatively small but robust evidence base demonstrates that content-rich ELA instruction can serve as an important context for simultaneously building both language and knowledge. So that's good. Background knowledge is good. What I am not saying here is that we should forget about the role of background knowledge. What I'm saying is that there's so much more in terms of what we can do, because what I tend to see is how, oh, so we're reading a science piece of work, so actually what we need to do is give them lots of content knowledge about the science. Yes, that's important, but actually there's lots of literacy knowledge that they need to learn and understand about as well. What I started to see as well was people perhaps, oh, we won't take people out for interventions like prediction inferencing. What we're going to do is that we'll then kind of give them, you know, lots of background knowledge. So we actually won't do many reading lessons anymore, or we'll just kind of integrate reading within the context of science, history, geography, et cetera, et cetera. I think there probably is a way that you can do that. But I still think there's a place for explicit comprehension teaching. And I'll kind of explain now as to what that looks like. And kind of conveniently, it was the part of the rope that I covered up at the beginning. So all this language comprehension. So definitely background knowledge is really important. But as I say, you can't teach everything. It's impossible to. So let's assume that as they go through geography, history, science, any subject, you're always building their background knowledge. So you're always kind of teaching something that could improve, you know, their reading from that. Vocabulary is really, really important. And to kind of just demonstrate that, I want to talk through this particular piece of research called the York Reading for Meaning Project. So it was done within 20 schools in the northeast of England, and it was a randomized controlled trial. So for us, it suits our kind of context. Randomized controlled trial, you hear, you know, the gold standards of educational research. So straight away, the kind of instructional design of this gets this kind of a thumbs up from me. And so what they wanted to do, or kind of this, they had three interventions that they were running. There was this oral language training, there was text level training, and there was this combined text level and oral language training. And what they surmised was that because all of these are related to reading and reading comprehension, you know, which of these is going to be the most effective? There were 60 sessions altogether, and those 60 sessions lasted 30 minutes long. And it was done over a 2 10-week period. This is what the oral language program looked like. Again, I'm not sure how well this you can see this on the screen, so I'll just go through it very quickly right now. So for the oral language, there was a 3-minute introduction, 5 minutes working on vocabulary, 7 minutes of reciprocal teaching style with spoken language. They get 5 minutes then of figurative language, but again, so no written text, just talking through what figurative language is, giving some examples orally, some spoken narrative intervention, and then a plenary. The text level looked like this. So they had the introduction, metacognitive strategies, reciprocal teaching, but with written language, 5 minutes on inferencing with text, 7 minutes on written narrative, and then a plenary. And then kind of our mixed variable then sort of combined, there was kind of two variants there. There was the introduction, then there was metacognitive strategies, reciprocal teaching with written language, reciprocal teaching with spoken language, figurative language, spoken narrative, and then kind of plenary. So you can kind of see here that metacognitive strategies comes from the text level. And then in the second variant of that, there was the introduction, vocabulary, reciprocal teaching with spoken language, then reciprocal teaching with written language, inferencing from text, written narrative, and then plenary. It's quite comprehensive. It was, as I say, it ran over kind of a couple of years. So there was a pre-test in October, then in from April to December, then there was this block, plenty of mid-tests, the other block, and then kind of another block, post-test. What they kind of did here, then it control block one, because obviously it was randomized control, so there was a control, so people who weren't getting any of these interventions, from an ethical perspective, giving, you know, children some interventions that may improve their reading comprehension, and then not giving it to another group of children, you know, is ethically on dodgy grounds, the researchers did come back to actually deliver this training for those pupils, which I kind of think is quite nice. So what's kind of important here, again, this idea of plenty of pre-test, mid-test, post-test, and then there's this maintenance test. So this idea then of actually, you know, Chris mentioned again, what are the effects? There's this immediate post-test, and then months later, when was another test, not with any teaching, you know, were the results after the post-test, were they maintained after a period of time? This is what they found. So oral language, just give you things. So term three is the, or T3 is the immediate after the intervention period. And then T4 refers to the months after the intervention. So obviously you have then oral language, text, and then the combined. So you can kind of see here, actually on the face of it, oral language, you know, comes out really strong initially after, in terms of maintained gains. It certainly had the highest kind of statistical relevance there with 1.24. Text actually didn't do so strong straight away, but did okay afterwards, but not actually as well then as the combined it, which I kind of find quite interesting. But when you kind of dig in though and read the kind of funky analysis that researchers do that yeah, I don't kind of quite understand, this is kind of what they reveal, is that the findings revealed the gains in reading comprehension scores at time four were partially mediated by gains in vocabulary. Children who received the combined program, their comprehension gains were entirely due to the growth in vocabulary. So thus, findings strongly suggest that one aspect of children's oral language skills, their ability to acquire and express vocabulary knowledge, is one cause of the improvement in reading comprehension. They go on, this coupled with the strong effect of the oral language program at time four provides evidence for the theory that difficulties with reading comprehension frequently arise from oral language comprehension difficulties, including but not necessarily restricted to limitations of vocabulary. So I think that's quite, for me, quite a conclusive piece of evidence to suggest that, you know, vocabulary is a massive factor in what limits comprehension. And so perhaps instead of taking children out and you know, giving them inference practice, prediction practice, retrieval practice, you know, just giving them some vocabulary practice, or, you know, some ideas to build their vocabulary are actually going to be really useful. So ways that you can do that, obviously I'm sure you're all kind of familiar with the Beck's kind of tier of instructions. That tier one is the everyday familiar words that you get through just your everyday conversations. Tier three are words that belong to kind of these subject specific groups. And then kind of like tier two are your, say, robust academy vocabulary words that students are likely to encounter across all topics and content areas. And people will say that, you know, tier two really are the words that you want to focus on because of that high leverage between their, you know, their transferability between different subjects. But of course, you know, tier three is going to be important as well. If you're coming across prime numbers in maths, you need to be able to disassociate, you know, prime numbers in the mathematical context and, you know, Amazon Prime, for example. So I say I'm also kind of passionate in that what can, you know, instructional time is very limited for teachers. What can we actually do to, you know, give teachers a decent steer as to what words then should we teach? Because yes, you know, there's an element of teachers going through whatever they might be reading and picking out that tier two vocabulary, but also I think having, you know, dare I say, some sort of list or, you know, guide to tell us maybe what some of these words are, that will be quite useful. So Avril Coxhead's high incidence academic word list is one of these. It's done in alphabetical order in this one, and the number after it refers to the frequency of it. So obviously if it's number one, then obviously it's going to be quite a high frequency word. So perhaps actually at primary school, from around, you know, maybe like year four, let's go through this list and teach them, you know, anything that has the number one, two and three afterwards, because those are, you know, high frequency, high academic words, and they might be used, you know, within text that children read. That could be quite useful. Again, thinking about then what plenty of research around this idea of morphology. So that's going to help with vocabulary, because obviously we can't teach every single word, but if we teach children the smallest, you know, parts of words that have meaning, so the morpheme, That's going to be useful because if I've never seen a particular word before, but I recognize chen or al or or ship, and I understand what that does to a word, then I'll be able to at least have a, using my prior knowledge, not necessarily just, reading around the word, I can use that knowledge to help me understand, what is this word actually trying to say. So again, this piece of work here, research here by in 2002, gives a rank order of suffixes from a corpus of children's literature, so age 7 to 12. So what kind of suffixes do we really want to make sure that children know by the time that they leave, would that be year 8? Well, if they know all of this, and this is a large corpus of words that they come across in children's literature that they are going to read. So we're thinking about good bets here. This seems like it might be a good bet to make sure children actually know what these words are because they appear a lot. One of my favorite pieces of research by Holly Lane, Linda Gutlone, and Wilhelma van Dijk is this morpheme frequency in academic words. If you've seen me talk about spelling, half the presentation just comes from this particular paper. But they took Avril Coxhead's academic word list. They took some textbooks from Texas, and they ran their statistical magic, and they kind of came back then with a collection of prefixes, Latin roots, Greek roots that you would find in academic language. They're able to kind of analyze that then can by kind of like full collection, so kind of the overall corpus. But then they're also able to look at that within a subject language, a subject level, so English language arts, so your literacy and your literature, maths, science, social studies, that's your history, geography, etc., etc. So they found that these were the common prefixes that appeared in these academic vocabulary in these particular subjects. So if we teach children the meaning of what these prefixes mean, then when children come across some different words, if they understand that bi is one, then that's going to be really useful. Or sorry, bi is two. That's going to be really useful when they come across words like bicycle or tri is three. Then obviously that's going to be useful then for when they come across words like trident, for example. They can picture it being a something to do with three at least. That kind of gives them a rough idea then of what that word might mean. As I say, she also then they also do a frequency of Greek roots in academic words as well. The other thing that we then can do is look at language structures. So here we look at something that's called anaphor. So it takes its meaning from another part of the text. It's called its antecedents, I believe, if I'm pronouncing that right. Common anaphors kind of include pronouns such as it, he, she, or they, and perhaps some verb phrases. So here, the children looked around the exhibition. When the alarm went off, they quickly found their teacher who led them to safety. For you to build up that model, you need to know who they and them refer to. And say this text looks at intervention studies again for weaker readers who, as I say, are in that kind of bracket of they're okay at decoding, but comprehension is going off. And this is something actually that can help pupils, asking pupils actually, well, who does they refer to? What's them referring to? Those things are helpful as well. And there are many kind of these as well. So there's kind of whole and part structure. So they took out some picnic supplies. The cider was warm. They need to make sense of that by actually understanding, that the cider was part of the picnic supplies. This idea of item and container. So the orange juice is in the container of the bottle. So when we say the bottle, we're referring still to the orange juice. This hyponym, looking at broadening these categories. So lager is obviously a type of drink. So kind of drink is a kind of higher order category that lager would fall into. And then kind of synonyms, which for me kind of falls into this vocabulary one as well. Glenn had a pile of jumpers, so understanding that pullover is a synonym for a jumper as well, kind of really important. Then we have things like conjunctions, prepositions, and adverbials, and actually kind of teaching children the meaning of what these means and their function is something that we can do to actually help with comprehension because all of these are going to impact that situational model. So There are kind of three sentences here which could, fundamentally change that construction integration model that you get. So June left the barbecue just before Bill arrived. June left the barbecue after Bill arrived. June left the barbecue at the very moment Bill arrived. So obviously, yesterday I watched the Glass Onion, Knives Out. So obviously, knowing when someone arrives could be, or when someone kind of leaves, is going to be fundamental to you then understanding that kind of that story. So really, really important that these are taught, but also thinking about then, well, how then do these impact that construction integration model? And then we kind of have our literacy knowledge as well. So this idea of concepts of genre. So obviously fully recommend you try to get through the seven basic plots. I think it's about 700 odd pages, something like that. But readers who are familiar with the particular structures of a genre of the text have several advantages. They know what to expect from different parts of the text, where to search for particular types of information, and how different parts of the text are linked together. The premise of Christopher's book is that every kind of story can be distilled into one of these seven basic plots. So actually, if we teach children what these plots are from quite a young age, then they'll be able to use that knowledge and use that information to help them understand other texts that kind of follow the similar plot, because they'll have a mental model for what's likely to happen in that text. So in these narratives, for example, it kind of concerns so like what the character is doing, what their actions might be, their mental states and emotions, the interactions with other characters or other items in the text, and also with the physical world of the narrative and have that kind of narrative point of view. So if we kind of can think about the books that we're reading to children, and if we can kind of like distill them into these kind of plots and talk to children about these, then obviously when they come to read their own, then they will get a full understanding of where this story might be going, and they can use that prior knowledge then when they're creating that construction integration model to kind of overlay that with what they're currently reading to help make sense and support that. And so kind of, I think for me, this kind of gives a quite a theoretical use perhaps to avoid not using whole text. So if you're only using snippets to parts of text, obviously then children aren't going to be able to get that full overarching arc or narrative arc. And so you need to make sure that you are definitely including kind of these full texts so pupils can experience these whole plots as well. But also within our informational or expository text, they follow a range of structures as well, such as description, sequence, compare and contrast, problem solution, cause and effect. And often the text will combine two or more of these structures. So actually teaching children that, these are kind of the signal words to look out for. This is what that text is doing. Again, that can kind of help build almost a framework for each text that pupils read, so they can attach things to that situational model so they don't have to work that hard. Some evidence for this, so a meta-analysis on the effects of text structure instruction on reading comprehension in the upper elements, in the upper elementary grades. So again, it is American. There are some, and obviously it's never going to, no research is going to be perfect, but I think it's a good bet that actually this is something that we could look at. I was a bit upset when I read the part where students who received text structure instruction no longer outperformed control groups at delayed post-tests. But again, when you kind of go in and read that, then actually the reason why that wasn't there is because actually they stopped teaching text structure. So perhaps their text structure wasn't long enough. But also they were tested later on text structures that they hadn't been taught. So it's not so surprising that in that post-test, they didn't perform better than control group. So it's definitely something that's still, so the evidence for it isn't solid, but I definitely think that there is enough evidence to say this could be a good bet. And obviously, of course, we have the master of kind of putting text structure together and thinking about how sequencing cause and effect might work, Ollie Cav's wonderful book, Dual Coding with Teachers, and the subsequent one that he did as well with Organizing Ideas can kind of show you how actually we can use these graphic organizers as a way in to help pupils kind of have that model for what this text structure might look like. And then we kind of come to the part where we need to talk about then strategies, not skills. Say there's a wealth then of other research out there about particular reading strategies that we could be teaching pupils that don't and will never kind of be used instead of skills or never instead of knowledge, but can kind of help if comprehension fails. There's something then that pupils can go back to kind of help them make sense of what they've read. Those of you will be familiar with the EEF literacy report. For the this one comes from Key Stage 1, Key Stage 2, and Key Stage 3. And kind of here, then you kind of have these kind of reading strategies with kind of prediction, questioning, clarifying, summarizing, activating prior knowledge. That's there in the Key Stage 1 and the Key Stage 2 one. I'm not so sure on the efficacy, perhaps, of these particular strategies. Some of them are okay. One of them, though, I'm not sure why is there. I don't think the evidence suggests that it needs to be there, particularly with Key Stage 1. And so we're going to kind of do a bit of a deep dive on this kind of prediction strategy. So first of all, and actually in terms of the research into comprehension strategies, there is very little of the research that suggests that this can be applied to children within the Key Stage 1 range. And when I look into the detail and the depth of the papers that go into making the EEF report, I think there are some potential, errors in how that was compiled, because you see quite a few of these studies mentioning sixth grade, which of course is our year seven. So there's that question then, can you actually use that to transfer over to primary school? I'm not so sure, but it's not just the case that there's one. There's quite a few instances where that's been done. When you look at the National Reading Panel, they were again, research in America. They put a very large report together in the year 2000 regarding, what high quality reading instruction will look like, including for including strategies. And they kind of don't mention anything about strategies being useful for children above year, what's that, the third and sixth grade range. So that would be our kind of year four. But when we look at prediction itself in kind of a bit more detail, these are the strategies that the National Reading Panel suggest. Comprehension prediction isn't there. So I kind of think that prediction, they put prediction in there because it relates back to that profile of content domains that we saw earlier, but also then from reciprocal teaching as well, which is a program used again to kind of help research, to help kind of teachers put something together to help and aid reading comprehension. Now, before Barack Rosenshine was all the rage with his 10 principles of instruction, or his 17 principles of instruction, he was doing some other work on reciprocal reading and reciprocal teaching, and actually did a lot of reviewing of the research behind reciprocal reading and teaching, which was used to kind of say that, prediction is a good thing. So let's have a look what he says about prediction. So, no relationship was found between the number of strategies taught and student achievement. Studies obtained significant results both when the investigators taught the four strategies identified by Palinska and Brown, and when they used two, three, or 10 strategies. So, despite the fact that Palinska and Brown argued that prediction was one thing, there was no relation to work out whether prediction was actually useful or not, because some studies only taught two, some only taught three, and some obviously tried some others as well. Not too fussed about this one, but it might be important that standardized tests were the outcome measure. All the results were non-significant and no differences between the two approaches, so the control group and reciprocal reading. When we look at the number of instructional sessions, so good, poor, all here refers to good decoders, poor comprehenders, or good at everything. And then you have kind of below average at everything. So some pupils who are good decoders, but poor readers, poor comprehenders, they could have had 50 sessions and still their ending result, that their change in comprehension from at the end of the study test, would be non-significant. Your son has 20 sessions, 25. It was good. Okay, fine. Here, again, below average. Some people's had 100 sessions of reciprocal teaching and you got non-significant results. But here, though, some people's got six. So a bit mixed, but for me, it's not coming out quite strong for reciprocal teaching and whether prediction belongs there. And then when you look at the size of the instructional group, it's all really, really small class sizes or just small groups of pupils. So things like, I don't remember the last time I had a class of 18 or 3 or 13 or 5 or 4, wherever it might be. So a lot of this kind of research here kind of goes beyond what might be possible in the classroom. So here, 22, the most significant, significant result only had, two people in at one point. At some point, 22 had an instructional group of 22 had non-significant. So imagine if that was that, if the 22 instructional group size was also the group size that had 100 instructional sessions, and you still came out as non-significant, it's an issue. Although students were then taught to make predictions and 12 to 18 of the studies, actually they were only assessed on this ability only once. And kind of to summarize there, we are uncertain which of the more effective strategies to use with reciprocal teaching and how many strategies should be taught. So for me, and again, it kind of goes back to what Cassie said, leaders tend to look at the headlines. They'll see that headline of kind of, right, okay, let's do those kind of five strategies that the EEF outline, and let's kind of get that going. But I don't think that the evidence is kind of there to suggest that prediction is a particular good use of time. As a pedagogical choice, maybe, nothing more exciting than getting, 30 year ones, year twos, showing them the book and, taking 2 or 3 minutes to perhaps to, guess and predict what might happen next. That's lovely. That's a nice little hook to get them into the story, to get them engaged. Not there as an aid necessarily for their comprehension. And then again, when it comes to these kind of comprehension strategies, a common retort back from some people is that, well, actually, a lot of the evidence suggests that they are done in kind of small instructional groups because they are done as interventions. So here's quite interesting research on it says intervention, reading strategy interventions, and like these are the strategies you would use for the intervention, but in a whole classroom setting. And again, it kind of reinforces actually what the National Reading Panel said, and that the studies made it clear that reading strategy instruction is effective for those in the middle and earlier grades. So grade 6 to 8, so that's basically from year 4 through to about year 9. Are substantial effects on research development measures of reading comprehension are found. However, for the older groups, though, so for our year 10s and 12s, the effects of reading comprehension is actually negligible. So that's kind of quite interesting for our, if there are any Key Stage 4, Key Stage 5 colleagues here. But certainly, in terms of teaching these things within the context of a whole class situation, yes, we can do things that will work. So things that we can do, comprehension monitoring, very simply, are pupils aware of them actually aware of when that comprehension model, that construction integration model has failed? So again, that's very simple. You can kind of show a sentence like this where it deliberately fails in quite an obvious way. So here, kind of, it rained hard, the ogre stood at the top of the tall cliffs that touched the blue skies. Well, obviously, you want children to actually stop and think about, well, actually, that can't be the case because, if it rained hard, it's unlikely that there's going to be blue skies and that. And so starting off to teach children things like this, to recognize these kind of clear, obvious errors in building those models, should then hopefully be able to help translate into them realizing, oh yeah, actually the I don't understand what I've just read. I need to go back and have a look at it. And as adults, we're guilty of reading, I think, 3 or 4 pages perhaps of a fiction or a research report and going, actually, I've got no idea what was mentioned there. So this is what they summarize about comprehension monitoring. Children in grades 2 through 6 can be taught to monitor their comprehension, become aware of where of they're having those difficulties, and learn procedures to assist them in overcoming the problem. There is evidence that this training has specific and general transfer benefits. So there's that transfer. The main transfer is to improve detection of text inconsistencies and memory of the text, and on standardized reading comprehension test performance. But again, we don't necessarily do it just to get better results at SATs. Question generation. This is very simply, are we actually getting pupils to think about those, those five W's in that house? So again, nice literature review here on self-questioning and reading comprehension. Large participants from a range of ethnicities, which is always, really important and nice to see. This is what they kind of say. So the mean length was roughly about, 1 to 6 months. So not too long at all, about 8.5 sessions, so not a lot either. And when you look at the outcomes, the vast majority of the studies finding generally indicate that students who use self-questioning strategies improved on their reading comprehension performance over and above either control conditions or control groups. This was the case for students with and without disabilities, and for students in elementary and secondary grades. For students who struggled academically, favorable outcomes were partially evident with explicit instructional components. Modeling guide practice, independent practice, were used to teach self-questioning. So again, self-questioning, I think, is particularly seems to have a decent evidence base that it's something that we could be teaching pupils to do when they kind of read these texts. And again, there's another piece of evidence and a bit of research to suggest the same thing as well. Summarization again is actually really useful for comprehension. So use, but because it gets kind of thrown against things of it as a skill, and because again it's really in that kind of, I think it was like 6 to 12%, it hardly ever comes up. But actually, there's a really good review here that, getting pupils to summarize, stopping them summarizing as they go along, kind of helps them actively engage and think about that text a little bit more. You're asking them to, to think deeply about it, and so obviously then they can, because they're thinking about it, obviously that model comes up. And actually, there are quite a few ways that you can teach, summarizing, which actually have some empirical findings, which I kind of find quite interesting because I had no idea about that. I had no idea actually how thinking about it. How did I actually teach summarizing before? And kind of this comes from Brown et al. Brown et al. And Day JD from 83, macro rules for summarizing text, particularly I think for informational text. But there are five things that you can do: delete trivial information, delete redundant information, superordination of lists, select the topic sentence, or invent the topic sentence. So let's do that really quickly now because I am over. You can see some small things with your eyes with the microscope. However, you can see much smaller details. Think of a butterfly's wing. You can see it with your eyes, but a microscope can show you small parts of the wing called scales. So the first thing I can do is kind of delete the trivial information. I can then kind of delete the redundant information that I definitely don't need. I got no superordination of lists here. What that would mean is that if I was reading, say, something about deserts and it mentioned three specific flowers, I could then, instead of writing down those three specific flowers, I could just go to a higher order category and just refer to them as flowers in general, rather than specifically saying the cactus, the daisy, the poppy, whatever it might be. Then I'll see if there's a topic sentence available, in which case obviously this first one usually does. And then interestingly, what they say as well, you kind of want children to really kind of remember what they've read. Take then this information away for them, and then ask children to invent their own topic sentence. So there's my own topic sentence that I've just kind of done there. And something like that. So if you're reading a long chapter book, getting pupils to do this as they read, spend some time at the end of a reading lesson, going through the paragraphs and thinking about what the main line, going through kind of this five step sequence, might be a useful way to make sure that model is effective and built and strong and sturdy. So when they come back to it next week, the next day, they're likely to remember what they've just read. Again, kind of going back to the effectiveness of reading strategy interventions in the whole classroom. It's a really good paper. I fully recommend if you're interested in comprehension at all, kind of do go and read it. But effectively, it says, these are still kind of really good things to do. Particularly this idea of setting reading goals, where you're kind of going into each session and you're kind of telling pupils, this is what you're going to get out of this. Like, I want you, we're going to read this text, and I want you to really understand what it is about ABC. So they have that goal in their minds. So that's what they're going to get out from. Not necessarily arbitrary goals like, oh, I need you to read this in like 5, 10 minutes for, say, to help with fluency or something like that. So kind of quick do and don'ts. I don't teach them in Q stage one. I honestly, I don't think there's any evidence for them in Q stage one. Do teach them in Q stage two and three, and you can teach them in a whole class setting. Things you should be teaching, I think, are comprehension monitoring, self-questioning, summarization, text structure, and I think I would add to that goal setting as well. Do use the gradual release of responsibility to teach them. So that's I, we, you. You don't need to spend too long teaching them explicitly. We don't know how long for. Research suggests Daniel Willingham came out with an article that said around 2 weeks is enough. That came from that Rosenshine research. Tim Shanahan said no, that's probably not long enough, but we certainly don't need to be doing it, for as long as we might do it as thinking about prediction skills and skills-based stuff. You probably want to teach them for about 3 or 4 weeks and then just make sure that pupils are obviously constantly reusing them. It might seem obvious, but don't force pupils to use them if they don't need them. The only reason you would need to use this strategy is if your comprehension has failed. You need to be strategic. The onus should be on the pupils to use these strategies. So it needs to come from them. Don't force a pupil to do summarization, self-questioning. Once you've taught them explicitly and said this is something that can help you, don't then have lessons where you're forcing necessary pupils to do this, because if they understand it and you know they understand it well enough, and that model, that construction integration model is absolutely fine, then they don't need to do it. Do not teach them as a means to pass standardized tests, because the research suggests they actually may not help with that. But also, we're teaching children here to be readers, not to just pass tests. And do not expect them to compensate for a lack of background knowledge. When I first did this, many teachers came up to me and said, right, but my school still wants a skills progression for reading. So this is kind of my best bets to what that might look like. Make sure pupils can decode. Make sure they can then decode fluently. Teach vocabulary explicitly, including Latin, Greek roots, and common affixes. Choose some really good books that most readers in the class would not be able to access independently to study as a class. Perhaps decide as a school as to what comprehending that text actually means. So what kind of themes, connections, main messages, knowledge do I actually want? It's the bare minimum that I want pupils to actually make from this. Obviously, 30 children are making that construction integration model, so it doesn't necessarily matter. It's not going to be the same, but there should be the lowest common denominator of what you think comprehending that text actually means. Map out your strategy instruction at Key Stage 2 only. This is for primary. As you're teaching, again, Ofsted say, curriculum is the progression model. So if you're saying these are the texts that we teach at year, in Key Stage 2, well, there's your progression model, as long as you're ensuring that pupils are actually getting those messages that you want, that you've agreed upon. A little bit of stats practice to get used to the question formatting is fine. It's useful. It'll probably actually increase the reliability that you're going to get, because I certainly remember that question where we teaching kids how to do a point evidence explain, and then it came up in a weird like kind of table where it was like put your point here, evidence there, evidence there, and lots of children just got confused because they weren't familiar with that layout of the question. So actually doing a little bit of that, absolutely fine, but it probably only needs to be done at around January of year six, I'd say, for them to get used to some questions. And where there's the asterisks, kind of just make sure that leaders know that this will not be a useful indicator for the actual stats, because I think it's kind of it just depends what comes up on the day. As I say, there's absolutely no research to suggest that this prediction comp inference skills stuff exists. So actually perhaps giving a some of these ideas a go that I've mentioned here might be a way that you can actually get children to become lifelong readers and not just readers to pass a assessment. I've overrun by 10 minutes, which is always going to happen, but if you've enjoyed any of this, again, obviously feel free to reach out for me. Thank you very much, everyone.